cover up your Freudian slip because it's time for Grain of Truth. Please welcome your host, Dave Anonymous.
Your Grain of Truth today.
Search engines are powered by burning lumps of search. You should always switch on an air conditioner once you've used the air shampoo. And musical tunes played on wooden drums can be replicated mathematically using logarithms. To introduce our panelists for this episode, it's over to the inversely parabolic Christian Bizzari.
Thank you, Dave. From the University of Adelaide, representing social studies, it's Vicky Kyriakakis. From the Emily Carr University of Art and Design, Granville Island, representing nanotechnology, it's Jürgen Schaub. From the University of Melbourne, representing mathematics, it's Roland Lewis. And from the University of Melbourne, representing literature, it's Tim Redmond.
The rules of Grain of Truth are simple. I award points to the panelists for their responses to the ridiculously absurd questions that I pose, as well as the scenarios and topics. Whoever has the most points wins the coveted Grain of Truth prize, which this week is the original design plans for Stonehenge.
Yes!
It was actually supposed to be an al fresco dining area. I love that.
I'll buy that.
Slightly low mumbled middle class laugh.
Outside in England, what were they thinking?
I know, that's why it wasn't finished. Before we begin the quiz, here's a small challenge for everyone. Can you name the grain of truth that connects all four of our panelists' names? That is Vicky, Jürgen, Roland, and Tim. And we'll come back to this at the end of the program, but I will give you a clue. Masks. Masks is our clue. But we now begin with round one, which is called the 90-second TED Talk. Each player must give a short speech on a topic relating to their field in 90 seconds. At 60 seconds, they'll get this noise. And which they have only 30 seconds remaining. We'll be starting with Vicky Kyriakakis, representing social studies, and your first topic is politicians have the worst job in the world. Vicky Kyriakakis, your time begins now.
It's true. They absolutely do have the worst job in the world. I mean, just for one thing, 20 million people conducting a job interview, what was that? Seriously, can you imagine the questions on that panel? Like, thanks for coming, Mr. Jones, we're going to take it in turns. Do you call those pants? When was the last time you went to a strip club? And say you even make it through, right? Say you get the job. Great, hooray for you. Now you get to dance with Beyonce at some point. No, wrong. Because now you have to deal with other politicians. Yes, my friend, worse even than having to deal with your average punter in the electorate whose whims and fancies rise and fall mysteriously with the latest clothes that the Kardashians wear. You're going to have to deal with your fellow wets and dries. Your moderates and wing nuts, your single causes and multi-causes, your potato heads and sociopaths, your one-time flingers and let's be lifetime frienders, and just that weirdo in the corner with the hat. We all know who we're talking about there. Oh no, it's only 60 seconds. I have so much more to say. And that's just in your own party. If you're unlucky enough to have to actually be elected leader of this ragtag bunch of popsicle-sucking politards, you're going to have to pulled them into that conga formation known as the party line. Yes, my friends, that thing which causes otherwise intelligent individuals to completely lose the capacity to form coherent sentences. The party line. Whether you're leading, following, or just moonwalking alongside, you're going to dance that sucker till it breaks you. Little known fact, question time was actually conceived of in 1754 by Lord Mimsy Porthington as a form of corporal punishment for peers of the realm who were too good at empathising with the hoi polloi, and they'd all stand on the other corner of the room hurling insults at them that they'd wrapped around little rotting potatoes that they'd stolen from the Irish. And while we don't bother with the potatoes anymore, this practice continues until you can achieve maximum impact. But if this still hasn't turned you off this profession for life, at some point, before you can get given your own ministry in an area you know nothing about, or even call yourself a career politician, you will have to undergo that final humiliating initiation called the kissing of Rupert Murdoch's left butt cheek. They will bring out a red cushion. You will be forced to kneel, pucker up, and think of England. You better hope he's using a good bidet the day your turn comes around.
You better hope he's in a good mood. But he is. Then, congratulations! You've got the job. Arise, Sir Minister of Flim Flam. You are now a real politician.
So we've got politicians that have got the hardest job in the world. Could there potentially be anything harder than being a politician, do you think?
Equally difficult or worse, probably being the politician's partner.
Right.
Specifically, Tony Abbott's wife. I really feel sorry for her.
Really? Oh. I'm sure she's...
Would you like to be Tony Abbott's wife?
Well, think of it this way. It's a very cozy job, I'd imagine. You get a very good house. I don't have to pay for rent. And all I have to do is just
sleep with Tony Abbott.
All right. Well,
man of priorities.
Our next speaker is Jürgen, who's representing nanotechnology, and his topic is practical nanotechnology. Jürgen Schaub, your time begins now.
So we all know what nanotechnology is now. A bit of a review. It's essentially making something that's already fairly small really tiny. Something that can barely be seen. So, for example, a nanomotor is just like the motor you'd find in a shaver or a toothbrush, but tiny. Carbon nanotubes, it's basically taking that bit in the middle of a pencil and making it tiny. Then nanofibers, it's taking your face washer and making it tiny. So what use are these little tiny vibrators, pencils, and face washers, aside from being expensive playthings for ivory tower scientists? I ask you, don't answer. Researchers at the University of Hyderabad in India, confronted by the epic levels of homelessness in the area, are producing some very exciting work. The premise is simple, yet profound. If we can fit more buildings into a city, there'll be more homes for residents. That's the breakthrough. So not content with these tiny vibrators, pencils, and face washers, taking something already fairly small and making it tiny, this group is making things that are normally huge, like multi-story apartment buildings, and making them small. One 50-story apartment building could fit about 500 to 700 people, but its footprint is massive, about 500 square meters. That's half a kilometer. Taking the basic idea of this building and making it a nano building, one that can fit in one square meter area but still hold the same number of people, means that with enough nano buildings, several million people would be able to live in that same half kilometer plot of land. The days of enormous, inefficient buildings are about to come to a close.
I love the concept of the nano building and reducing things to fit more things. Could the concept of nanotechnology could be applied to other things? For instance, would you believe in things such as the nano relationship?
Oh, of course. Yeah, that happens all the time. It's called Tinder.
Absolutely. Our next speaker is Roland, and your topic is pi is equal to 3. Roland Lewis, your time... We have offended the mathematician in the audience. This is a deeply controversial topic.
Yes.
But your topic, pi is equal to 3. Roland Lewis, your time begins now.
Pi equals 3. It shouldn't. And I blame the physicists. You see, mathematics is a discipline as pure as Heisenberg's blue crystal meth. It gives so much while alienating so many. And pi is no exception. This enigmatic, impossible number coveted by so many mathematicians describes the ratio of a circle's circumference to its radius. Now, the definition of a circle is vital to this argument. A circle is a series of infinite points, all situated exactly the same distance from a central point. Now, infinity, it is such a complex, confounding concept for the human brain to process, and it is pure mathematical concepts like this that has given birth to the natural enemy of the mathematician, physicists. You see, physicists are simply mathematicians with the inability to conceptualize. They are the kind of person who cannot count without counters and cannot rationalize equations like Fg equals M1, M2 over R2 without gravity. And it is this over-rationalization of mathematics and this constant connection to what physicists call real life that has led to the belief that anyone can do math. So, this physicistic dumbing down of maths has led to pi being accepted as 3.14. And now it is common to see people attempting to draw this beautiful theoretical shape. As such, circles are no longer circles, simply abominations with no symmetry. with no perfect curve. Just an infinite number of points, situated at an infinite number of distances from a number of random points situated somewhere in the middle. And if you take all these circles, and you take the circumference, and you divide it by these radii, you find that because there is so much inaccuracy, that the answer is simply 3. I'm disappointed, everyone. Circles are not for drawing. They are to be conceptualized. Now, you take all that as you would, but the Bible says it's 3. And God knows that's a testament of truth. Seriously, Google it.
As a chemist by nature, I have to say that I completely, fully and utterly accept that physicists are awful.
Physicists are to blame for the dumbing down of everything.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What else have they dumbed down, do you think?
General relativity.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Gravity. Mm. Yeah. Space-time.
Yeah.
All those things. It's terrible.
And that whole business with the cat disappearing and getting gassed and stuff, that's just...
Yeah, totally.
That's
totally. If you can write it in a book, it's dumb.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. We're now moving on to our final speaker for the first round, which is Tim Redmond, and your topic is the book is not better than the movie. Tim Redmond, your time starts now.
Hello, everyone. How often have we gone to see a movie and you come out with your compadre and they say things like, oh, it wasn't as good as the book. The book's better than the movie. Slap them. Granted, some films are so bad you could legitimately claim that the video game was better than the movie. This is a failure of filmmaking. This has nothing to do with those precious things you keep on the shelf with words in the pages. This has nothing to do with author's soul on the page for you. This is about filmmaking. A book is a book, and a film is a film. And to demonstrate this, I'll give you the one film that is inexorably better than the book. And I'll give it to you in 2 notes, and you'll know what it is. Jaws. Jaws. Has anyone read this trashy piece of pulp by Peter Benchley? Steven Spielberg, a master filmmaker, took this trash onto a set and created a cinematic masterpiece. Every inch, every sound, every element of life. Peter Benchley, the author of Jaws, was on set and famously had a complaint of Spielberg. He said, he knows only movies. Like this is a complaint. No, what Spielberg knew is that a movie is a movie. Like Coppola, when he made The Godfather, he tore each page of that book, put it onto an A0 piece of scrap, and he circled what was needed for the movie. If it wasn't circled, it wasn't in the film. He's a filmmaker. Sure, this Jaws movie gave a generation of people an unmathematical fear of the water. And there will be people who tell you that more people die from bee stings each year than are eaten by sharks. But bees don't come plummeting up from the depths like a freight train with teeth to bite you in half and then eat you from the head down. Movies are primal. Books are personal. A book is an affair. It's tender, it lingers. You can walk past a bookstore and you know that their book is in there. If you see someone else reading your favourite book, it's offensive. You don't love it. I love that book. A movie is a campfire. It's the one time, no matter how shy or introverted you are, you crave 1,000 other bodies in the dark to sit before the lighted screen and all move and make primal noises together. A book is a book. And a movie is a movie. Let us never, ever again leave the cinema and say, I preferred the book, because it's a different thing. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, this would be an excellent question for the panel if we had Jaws as an excellent film rather than the novel. If there is a favourite adaptation that you might think was either really good or perhaps even better than the original source material, has anyone else got favourite adaptation films?
Super Mario Brothers.
Do you mock me, sir?
Way better than the book.
I'd love to see
the book is amazing.
Yes, it is.
I'd love to see the novelization of Super Mario Brothers.
Oh, don't get me started on fan fiction.
Mario was perambulating one day when he thought he jumped.
And punched a brick.
Whoosh! Went the brick.
This is the thing that made me think many great movies are made from short stories, like Brokeback Mountain is a great example. Short stories are great for adaptation of movies because what you do is actually fill the gaps rather than upset punters who walk out when all the movie they're seeing while reading the book is not up on screen.
Shawshank's a good example of that.
I think short stories, that's the way to go if you're a filmmaker. It's offence-free.
And similar, I think that 1984 actually improves on the novel of 1984. I don't know, how dare I? Because it takes all the crappy bits and cuts them out and just leaves all the rest. And just have this wonderful film about a really depressing future. It's great. It's super.
I'm going to say people are going to shoot me. Lord of the Rings kind of does the same.
No, I commend you, Vicky Kyriakakis.
Look at that. You get one whole commendation. There we go. At the end of that round, it appears that Roland Lewis is in the lead by 4-7. Yes. Our next round is the analysis and application round. Our panel is divided into teams of two and must apply their skills to an application task. Vicky and Jürgen, you're first, and I'll be challenging you to a round that we call the Dictionary Corner. I'm going to give you some words, and you must give me the dictionary definition, including whether it's an adjective, a noun, verb, or, dare I say, adverb.
Not the adverbs.
Then at least one possible definition. Your first word is herbalostasis.
Herbalostasis, yes. This is a condition whereby if you eat too much basil, you go into a coma.
Yeah, exactly. And the only way to wake you up is with pesto.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Little known fact.
Yeah. Our next word here is gawping.
Gawping. It actually happens when you're drowning. You're in the middle of, you're just about to drown and you're gasping for air, but the water's coming in and you're making this sort of frog sound.
Yes,
gawking. The next word, ocular.
Oh, now you're just asking for it, Dave.
That's in fact the definition, I'm just asking for it.
Isn't ocular a girl's name?
Oh, yes. Next word is ferndicative.
Yes, this is where you find yourself in a forest and there's a lot of trees around and you're getting lost and one of them just goes, it's that way.
Yeah. It's actually meteorology is actually, it's a New Zealand word because they often find their way around the forest using the ferns, and the ferns are quite predictive about that.
And finally, this one actually comes from an encyclopedia, but it's the term Frumpton's necktie.
It's one of these things that you wear in your pocket. It's like a sort of a handkerchief thing. It often matches one's tie. And it's named that because the person who, Frumpton, the man who actually started this, didn't like wearing a necktie. And what he did one day is take his necktie off and shove it in his pocket. Thus, Frampton's necktie.
Yes, and actually it also doubles up as a term for a certain style of argument where you're actually using completely the wrong facts to try and argue a point.
That doesn't
sound
at all.
It's Frampton's necktie.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Vicky and Jürgen. Roland and Tim, I'll be challenging you to an old-fashioned round of mathematical problem-solving.
Very good, very good.
I have taken these from the Maths Quest 7 for the Australian curriculum, in the problem-solving section.
My Achilles heel.
These will later be used in NAPLAN testing. Education reference. So no calculators permitted, and you must show you're working. The first one. A train goes 100 kilometres per hour from Box Hill to Camberwell. It reduces its speed by a third at Canterbury for an inexplicable reason, but only during an odd-numbered time between 10 and 11 a.m. To three decimal places, how annoyed are the people on Canterbury platform?
To measure this, we must first introduce the increment of frustration, which is the thrust.
It's a measure of personal aptitude, as is divided by your ability to cope with situations.
Right. Which forms itself quantifiably on the face as a furrow. And you can measure three furrows of thrust by how many wrinkles you have on your face. That explicit example
the 100 kilometres an hour on the Box Hill to Camberwell line results in 9 to 12 deaths. The inexplicable stopping is the train driver's guilt at realising that this is carnage. This is Zone 1 carnage. So therefore, there would be no thrust, not one furrow on that brow. Because as people, we would understand that someone else's sudden death is more important than our delay. The answer is zero.
I need it to three decimal places, please.
0.000.
Oh, thank God! And the next problem here. John has three apples and gives Maria an X amount. She can produce 150 mils of fruit juice given an even ratio of mangoes to apples. She can produce two-thirds the amount given a Y amount of strawberries. What volume of vodka is required?
Excellent question. If you substitute in for X and Y, the...
Do you need the question, by the way? I thought I'd pass that to
you. Oh, of course! Yeah, it's clear now. I missed that she had 150 mils of fruit juice. It's obvious that the volume of vodka to fruit juice is always a one-third ratio. It doesn't matter what kind of juice she has or the manner that she makes it. It is a constant equation that is always exactly the same. So it's one-third.
Yeah. Splendid. And ladies and gentlemen, it's Tim and Roland. Fabulous. And at the end of that round, Tim is in the lead by 2 hectares.
Wow. A good house on my lead.
Our next round is called Stumble, Mumble or Bumble. The players are challenged to answer quick-fire ridiculous questions, and if they stumble, mumble or bumble, other members of the panel can go and chime in using their bell. And so they can go and steal the topic. Or alternatively, if I feel that everyone's being far too polite, I'll squeak in and I'll give the topic away to someone at random. Our first speaker is Tim, and your question or topic, let's put advertisements in books.
Totally put advertisements in books because, well, for one thing, you know when you get to those bits where it's not the exciting stuff, like say you're reading a romance novel and it's not the sexy stuff, you want an ad right there.
That's known as an editor, not an advertisement. If a book needs advertisements, it is not a book. It is a manuscript. A book is a complete thing. It is words on a page. We can have etchings if it's Dickens. We do not need advertisements. We do not need the encouragement.
An etching could also be...
Shut up! I wasn't finished! Well, we solved that one.
Let's move on, shall we? Thank you. Roland, we'd like you to continue with a different topic. Everything is better in threes.
Everything is better in threes. You only need to look at comedy to see that jokes are funnier after three. You only need to look at bees. Bees work better in threes. You also only need to look at numbers. Pi equals 3. Books have all got three advertisements in them. The perfect advert is the third one, which makes you actually buy the thing they want you to buy.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go with the new topic for Jürgen. Our brain is an organic version of Facebook.
Oh, that's quite obvious. When you look at the diagram of a brain, you see the cerebellum, you see all the other bits, and you look at the page of Facebook, you see like the bit in the middle, and then there's a bit up here which is like Facebook inside Facebook, and then there's the ads, all the ads, and your brain is full of ads just like books.
Oh, thank you. I'll leave it there. I'm going to throw it back over to Vicky. Vicky, what will happen when we colonise Mars?
We're all going to die because there's no atmosphere. Really, we're going to go up there with our little space machines and kind of step out and be like, and then we're going to die. And then he's like,
I feel that Vicky is going in the wrong direction with this. I believe that if we were smart enough to make the decision to colonise Mars, clearly we must have been smart enough to figure out a way to make Mars habitable. For instance, it would have...
There's a term for that sort of argument. It's called Frumpton's necktie. There's no way we'd be that smart. We'd just be like, woo, Mars.
Once we come to the point of colonizing Mars, we'll also come to the point of being able to randomly insert and delete memories into people's brains. One person got the Total Recall reference. Thank you.
Of course. And
people are laughing at home.
Listen to it.
I can hear it. I can hear it.
And lastly, Tim, kittens are the harbingers of doom.
Well, you're either a dog person or you're a cat person, aren't you? There's no puppy person and kitten person. You're a dog person or a cat person. The fact that a kitten has introduced itself into the sentence, not naming itself as a cat, is an indication of their subterfuge. The harbingers of doom. No, no, I'm not a cat, I'm a kitten. Kittens grow up to be cats. The duplicitous little furry fiends that roll over and look cute, and when you scratch their belly, what do? They scratch you back. A dog.
Kittens are not always the harbingers of doom. Sometimes they're actually quite useful. There is a browser plugin available right now that replaces all pictures of Tony Abbott with pictures of a cute kitten.
And on that irrefutable evidence, it's the end of the round! Now, I currently still have to total the points to find out who wins our Grain of Truth prize, but before we do that, it is now time to reveal the answer to the Grain of Truth connection challenge. And firstly, anyone on the panel, did you get the connection between the names Vicky, Jürgen, Roland, and Tim?
I did.
Oh, and what might that be?
The last letter of each of our names spell out the word mind, which is a mask of the subconscious.
Oh, you are being blessed! Oh my god, he's right! That's much better than what I wrote, but... The connection that I had here, although I do love that one very much, was Batman, and I'll explain why. Vicky Vale is a journalist for the Gotham Gazette. Jürgen Blank is a student at Hamilton Hill High in Gotham City in the Batman Beyond series. Roland Daggett is the president of Daggett Industries and is an enemy of Batman in Batman the Animated series.
Bloody Batman.
And Tim Drake is the third Robin in the Batman comics. And currently, he's a superhero in his own right with the very clever name Red Robin. So there's our connection, but I will also give some extra points there. But it remains for me to total up the points, and the winner of the original plans for Stonehenge is Roland Lewis! End of the program, and I hope you enjoyed it. You can come and see the recording on the first Saturday of the month at 1 p.m. at the Wesleyan. Our website is www.grainoftruth.com.au, and you can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/grainoftruth, and on the Twitter @grainoftruths. Now it leaves me to thank our panel, Vicky Kyriakakis, Jürgen Schau, Roland Lewis, and Tim Redmond, our announcer, Christian Bazzari, our composer, Matthew Headcraft, Damien Sutton, and the Wesleyan. I have been your host, David.